Session number 27342, Reel 2.
Jack Thomas, Reel 2. Were the huts inspected at all?
Oh yes, they're very fussy about everything being folded in the right place. Again, my cadet training had helped there, so I didn't bother me. Some people it did. But I sort of expected that anyway. That didn't make a great mark. I was interested in the fact that everybody were very particular about cleanliness. It was, you know, everybody had to be scrubbed and polished and that. All through my time in the Navy, I realised this is the great thing about the Navy, that your cleanliness was one step ahead of godliness as far as they were concerned, yes.
Did you have any instruction in sort of basic seamanship?
Not there. No, it was the next stage. That's when this all started, HMS St Vincent, which was the second stage of my career, in a sense.
So, was there any period while you were still at Daedalus that you did familiarisation with naval procedures and uniforms, that type
of thing? Oh, yes, I see what you mean. Yes, of course, yes. They gave us little talks on the sort of the historical side of the Navy and why the, you know, on your uniform, what it meant, and naval routine, and how you addressed people and that sort of thing. Yes, that sort of basic stuff I obviously was there. Yes, but not really seamanship instruction as such. That came later.
So it was a mixture of, if I'm right, familiarisation with the Navy and really kind of basic army training.
Basically, yes. Because the Navy always had and has used landing parties where necessary to act as soldiers, in a sense. I mean, like the Royal Naval Air Service in the First World War had armoured cars and had a sort of fought in the trenches as well, some of them. You know, yeah.
So you mentioned a couple of things you trained me, obviously the rifle training,
yes,
and bayonet practice and hand grenade throwing. Did you say you trained with the Lewis gun as well?
Lewis gun as well, yes, which made you deaf in one ear for the day. You know, they didn't have ear protection in those days. If you were loading, you put the pan on top and the chap firing had pulled the trigger and there's this deafening noise. I remember that was the thing that struck me more than anything else. I never realised how loud guns were. Even a rifle, you know, we did a little bit of rifle practice, and I'd never fired a rifle before. I'd drilled with them, the cadets, but never fired one. And I didn't realise what a big bang it was. That's the thing that struck me more than anything else. Going to the pictures, watching the cowboy films, we just bang, bang, bang. But it was quite a deafening crash, and the gun didn't half kick as well, didn't half hit you on the shoulder. And when the Lewis gun made a terrible racket, and black powder flying out all over the place, yes. Very dramatic, though, quite exciting, yes. So that's
what about the hand grenade flown? I mean, you mentioned one incident that occurred, but what about yourself?
I enjoyed the bang, you know, so I was seeing this bang. This was all part of the game of it, in a sense, you see. I mean, all right, we're in the Navy, but we're playing soldiers, put it that way, you understand what I mean. And but we're looking forward all the time to, you know, when are we going to get to aeroplanes, sort of thing. It was a long time before we did, but that was the thing. We wanted to be fly aeroplanes. Why are we doing this sort of thing, you know?
So the next move was to St Vincent.
HMS St Vincent, yes, at Gosport.
How long did you been on the basic training?
About a month. And then I think it was 3 months at St Vincent, which was real naval training then, because there we did, we carried on with the drilling, and it was much more strict there. Everybody who went to St Vincent, and all pilots and observers and air gunners in the fleet era went to St Vincent. Everybody knows St Vincent. This is one thing I think why the fleet era is a bit like members of the same school. Unlike the Army and the RAF, where you could go to the regular Navy, half a dozen different training places, all air crew went through this one slot of St Vincent. And at St Vincent was a man called Chief Petty Officer Wilmot. And everybody knows about Chief Petty Officer Wilmot. Wonderful chap. He was a hard man. We thought a very hard man, very hard on us, really. Underneath, he had a heart of gold. He was an amazing person. Anybody who'd been through St Vincent, when he met them later on at any time during the war, he knew who they were, what course they'd been on, and everything. A remarkable person. And he was a chief gunner's mate, a chief GI, which is a sort of, we were told, was the sort of most important person in the Navy. And the GIs there, the gunner's mates, were very tough people. They were all Whale Island trained, and they believed in everything being done absolutely perfectly. And I remember Wilmot, when he started for every morning, he was stood around the outside of the parade ground. And he'd come out to the middle of the parade ground smoking a cigarette. He'd drop it on the ground, screw it out with his heel, and there was a patch about 6 inches in diameter of black on the parade ground where he dropped the cigarette every morning, exactly the same place. And he'd shout, and a voice that echoed around the whole of the southwest of England, the south of England, "Marcus!" And the people who were designated as Marcus had to fly out on the parade ground, take up their position, and then fall in. You fell in on them. And we did our drilling there. And it was really, they were very, very fussy about that indeed. But the main part really was we did seamanship and some basic airmanship as well. Not a lot of the airmanship, just really to remind us that we were going to fly in future. But basic was seamanship, everything from pulling boats in the harbour to sailing, sea navigation.
Can I take you through some of those actually?
Yes.
Can you tell me about the boat pulling? What was the instruction on boat pulling?
Right, we used to pull around cutters and whalers in the harbour there. I remember being taught a very unpleasant lesson there, which was a very useful one. We were coming alongside in the boat, and I had my hand over the side of the gunwale of the boat, and the petty officer who was drilling us got hold of an oar, and he hit me on the knuckles with his oar, and it was terribly painful. And he said, "It's much more painful, son, if you come alongside like that." He said, "It'll take your fingers off." I learned that lesson there, yes.
How difficult was it to get you all rowing together?
Well, quite tricky, obviously, to start with, but they shouted at us well and truly, and we were so frightened of them anyway. You know, these people are sort of from beings from another world. And the strange thing was that wherever they came from around the British Isles, they all had the same accent, a sort of this gunner's mate's accent, which is a bit of Portsmouth, a bit of London in it. Strange thing that they all were the same. They all came out of the same mould. And we had other seamanship instructors. One was an interesting chap. He was a three-badge AB, actually. In other words, he had no promotion. He got three long service stripes on. But he taught us bends and hitches. That is, tight ropes, bends and hitches, and about ropes. And I mean, all his little quirks, like when you're getting a piece of rope, how to finish it off and work it. Worm and parcel with a lay, turn and serve the other way, things like that. And he used to say to us, now he always got dressed on his madeiras. And apparently women he addressed as Madalyn, but all men were Madeiras, you see. He said, "Now, Madeiras, I'll give you a tip." He said, "Never, ever wash the middle of your back. It's very weak then." "I've never washed my back in all my life." And he said, "I'm very healthy now." I don't know how old he was. To us, he looked about 80. He must have been about 45, I suppose. He's one of these other things he used to say was, "I played cricket with Jack Obbs. I played cricket with Jack Obbs." Yes, that was his great thing. Funny thing about this, I can't remember his name now, but while we were there, he was coming in from being ashore one night, and he fell into the harbour because he wet his back, didn't he? So you know, we often wonder whether he had any weakness after that.
He said he was instructing you in knots and in his language. But yeah. What was the technique? How did they teach you knots?
Well, two ways. They had examples of knots on a board, you know, pieces of rope set out. And they went through with you with the instructions about how to turn it, how to handle it and everything. We did all the usual things, and you learnt the whole range of knots, which are quite useful, really. And, bowline on a bite, and exotic ones like that, and sheep shanks, and ordinary ones like reef knots and that sort of thing. But they were very keen that you should do this, you see. And we did Morse code as well with a radio, and also with Aldous lamp. We only had to do I can't remember that rate was, about 12 words a minute, not very much. The observers who were on a parallel course, they went into it much more deeply because that was their side of things. But we did carried on with things like air recognition and ship recognition as well, with model ships and sort of, you know, like epidioscope slides and things like that, you see, ship recognition. And they used to play tricks on you by altering ships, you know, moving things about to see if you could recognise the ship and that sort of thing. I always remember somebody, the great joke about the person, remember the Nelson and the Rodney were two big battleships, and the superstructure was all towards the stern, and all three gun turrets were on the forward part of the ship. Remember somebody describing the Nelson Rodney said in an exam, so they were supposed to say this, that in the Nelson the Rodney, the bridge is a long way astern of the ship. which actually gives a picture of it anyway. But so we had this seamanship, and we did sea navigation, and we had quite a lot of tests and exams. The thing we had to, at the end of the three months, we had to pass some written exam, of course, and all sorts of different things, meteorology and practical examples of this bends and hitches, that sort of thing, and answer theoretical questions as well, and do a little bit of navigation problems. So it was quite, it was both theory and practice in this case, quite demanding, really. And you really felt you were in the Navy then. We're still thinking, well, where are the aeroplanes? That was always at the back of our mind, you see. You must remember this. The food there was awful. It was absolutely abysmal. It was dreadful. It was, I remember, it was Stan Brand who said he bit into a meat pie and he found there was a mouse's head in it or something, which sounds really nice. We used to have what was called corned beef hash, and it had little crunchy stuff on the top, but we reckoned the crunchy stuff was mainly cockroaches, which fell off the ceiling of the cook place. And they had this dreadful duff, which was the pudding, a sort of a naval, fruit steam, suet pudding, which was mixed by wrens with wooden paddles. These wrens, who where they got them from, I don't know, but they weren't the normal sort of glamorous wrens you saw in most places. They worked with wooden panels on a sort of brick floor, stirring this duff up, which was cooked in great big vats of greasy water. And it had when it was cooked, it had a half-inch layer of sort of yellow fat on the top. Well, most of us, the food was dreadful. And the idea was, at the end of your meal, you went along with your eating irons, and there was a cold, once hot bowl of soapy water, which was cold and glutinous. You rinsed them with that, and you dried them by drying the knife and fork under your armpit. That was the thing you had. So most of us, a lot of us, spent most of our time in the naffy, where the food was quite good, rather than going to the official meals there. quite a demanding time. I can remember when I got to the end of the course, we became leading seamen, leading naval airmen, put a hook up on our arm. We felt very proud about that. We'd earned it. And I remember going on leave, and there were two incidents there. The first one was, I had all my books and things with me. I was going on leave, and there was a leading seaman sitting opposite me, real Navy, you know, looked at me, and I had my white hat band on, and the leading, he said, "How long have you been in the Navy?" And I said something, well, however it was, yeah. And I've been in 5 years before I got my hook. You must have got it very easy. I got annoyed at him, so I got my books out, and I said, "Have a look at those. I've been doing this for three months, you see." He said, "Okay, Jack, you've earned it." Handed me books back again.
How did you manage to study? Obviously, the books that you did in your accommodation.
As best as you could. In your barracks. We're in barracks there, again, with double or treble tier bunks and things like that. And there were classrooms as well. You could use classrooms for studying. It was up to you how you fitted it in. You had about 50% of the time be practical lectures, and the other time be theoretical ones. theoretical lecture on the on the Lewis gun. We were terribly cruel. We had an old leading seaman used to teach us this, and he used to say, I can't remember the actual deal, something like this, "The Lewis gun is 27 half inches long, weighs 18 half pounds, and fires around 200 rounds a minute." "How long is the Lewis gun?" "The Lewis gun is 27 half inches long, weighs so and so and so and so." "Oh, yes, yeah." "And then how many rounds a minute does it fire?" "The Lewis gun is 27 half inches long." And we went through that. It was Trent. We were awful like that. He'd learnt it by rote, you see. And I remember doing this, then we had to learn stripping it down off it. And a little thing I remember about on rifles as well, on parts of a rifle, the rear sear, retainer, keeper. It was one little part of the rifle. I can't remember what it was now at all. We had all these practical side of things as well. Yes.
You said a little bit about airmanship, really,
yes,
hadn't you? What did that involve?
Not very much. Just a little bit of, in fact, hardly worth mentioning. They just told us that we would be doing air navigation later on, and when we learned to fly, we'd need to use this Morse code operating in the aeroplanes and this sort of thing. But it was still ahead over the horizon, this thing, you see, looking forward to over the horizon.
But were you learning the principles of navigation?
Sea navigation. Sea navigation, yes, which is a lot of basically the same sort of thing, really, when you think about it. Winds and tides. You didn't have the tides when you were flying, but the winds were the same. And we learned also about map reading and chart, reading charts, of course, which was quite useful as well, yes. And then we, as I say, we moved on from there. That's when the second amusing incident on the train. I was talking to a very glamorous wren. I thought, my God, this is good. I'm in here. I mean, lovely girl. She was beautiful, blonde, and we're talking so and so. And it came out in the end that she was 22. I thought, oh, gosh, she's an old woman. Far too old for me. I was 18, you see. Mustn't take this any further. Isn't that amazing? I think about this now, about how old you were, how you felt, you see. 22, she was old, yes.
How did you feel at the end of the course?
We felt pleased that we got through, because there were people dipped, quite a few people dipped on the way. A few at the first month at Lee, but quite a few, I don't know how many. The whole course would be 180. And I suppose you'd lose something to perhaps 20 to 30, maybe 40, on that particular part of the course. People couldn't cope with the academic side or the other side, or this mysterious OLQ had cropped up for some reason. Perhaps there was a commander on the top floor with binoculars watching how you walked across the parade ground. I don't know, we never knew that. So it was a sort of mystery, this sort of thing. Anyway, when we got through there, you really felt pleased with yourself. You know, you got something, you'd earned this hook on your arm, this killick. It was, you were now a leading naval airman. You're no longer the lowest form of knife in the Navy. You were sort of upper stage, you see. Acting leading airman to start with, then after 6 months, leading naval airman, you see.
What about the backgrounds of your fellow recruits at that time?
Oh, all sorts of people from all sorts of backgrounds. Ray Ligo, who'd come in he'd worked as a copy boy at the Times. And hadn't even got a school certificate, finished up as an admiral, you see. Other people who had got quite well on, who were about to start a university with the high school certificates and things like that. So there's a whole range of it. We had two people who came up from ordinary seamen, up from the lower deck as ordinary seamen, and we were a bit frightened of them, because they were tough-looking characters, you know. Their caps were nicely bent, and their collars were nice and pale. And the uniforms are very tiddly, you know, not at all official. So, but a very mixed bunch, yes. Great deal of camaraderie and friendship, though, because we're all. It was a bit like, to some extent, was being in prison. In fact, that you were under control all the time, you know, this sort of thing. And when you were allowed out, as we're told, you weren't allowed out. You went ashore. You see, you went ashore. And he went ashore in Liberty Boats. And the Liberty Boat was a group of people walking out through the gate at a time. Same time, you see. 20 people walking out. That was the 1600 Liberty Boat, that sort of thing. And you picked up the naval parlance. That was important that you did that, you see. That you were Navy. There was no doubt about it. They were really making sure of that before they let us loose on anything to do with aeroplanes. Yeah.
And how important was appearance?
Oh, very important, yes. They were very particular about inspection at Vincent. Yeah, everything had to be just so. And you got into the habit of doing it. It became second nature. And this idea of looking after yourself and looking after things, which to me it was quite an eye-opener, having been looked after by my mother, you know, for 17 years. That was a thing that changed. You became self-reliant to that extent, that you were prepared to do things which you'd never done before. I mean, I'd never travelled, well, I had to have been to Australia back, but not under my own steam. But to me, that was, and the idea that you went on leave and you got train, you got a warrant, you went on a train, you did this, you went through the underground, struggling with two kit bags, you said, that was it. I remember going on leave, this was the first leave, and really feeling proud of myself in my uniform, you know, there I was, sort of thing. And all my friends and relatives all wanted to see me, and yes, it's really good. It's quite a good feeling, that. And then, but still, there was this over the horizon. Where are the aeroplanes? Where are the aeroplanes? Yes, and that was the next step.
So, can you take me through the next step? Would you
yes.
Back off leave.
Okay, back off leave, and we went. We got a warrant to go to. We had a choice. There were three possibilities. We could have gone to RAF station at Elmden near Wolverhampton, to RAF Sealand. Or to Pensacola in America, and they divided you arbitrarily among these particular things. if you couldn't swim, you had to go to Elmden because that was inland. If you had, could swim, you could either go to Pensacola or Sealer because there was water around the place, you see. And the little story that about it, Vincent, they did your swimming test to see if you had to swim two lengths in a boiler suit to sort of prove you could swim. And there's one chap who was, he didn't realise that he thought you had to learn to swim, whether you could or not. Although he couldn't swim, he jumped in and he dog paddled two lengths because he was so frightened of the petty officer told him to swim. anyway, I went to Sealand, RAF Sealand, and this was a revelation because it was incredible. We had sheets on the beds, we had pillows and pillowcases. We ate in a place where there was a chef with a white hat who stood at a counter and carved meat from a joint. It was all beautifully clean. It was, and the food was excellent. It was incredible, really. We thought, this is something different. They must be a very pansy lot in the RAF, you know. but we started our flying training.
Can you describe the airfield to me?
Actually? Yes, the airfield was... divided by the main road ran down, sort of split the residential quarters from the airfield. The residential quarters were very nice. I think it was actually built originally at the end of the Second World War. It was a well-established peacetime establishment, and the barrack blocks were very nicely fitted out with, you know, good toilets and proper like dormitories, really, everything like that. The airfield, every morning you marched across as a body over the bridge, over the road to the airfield, and then you split up into different flights. And there were six flights, I think, remember? Five flights, that's right, A, B, C, D, and E flights. Each of them had a hangar where they had their lessons. There was a classroom there, and you had your aircraft that you were using there, and your instructors. And I mean, I was in E flight, which was E flight, the last flight in Flint, because it was just on the border between Cheshire and Flintshire there, and our hangar was just inside, just in Wales, and there. And the first thing we did, we really then started off on some air navigation, the theoretical side of things like meteorology and that kind of thing as well. We had RAF instructors there, and they seemed a little bit more friendly in many ways than some of the naval instructors had been. They hadn't got, we were already broken in, I suppose that was the idea. And we learned things about clouds, the different types of clouds there were in the meteorology. Navigation, we learned about the sort of instruments that we'd use, how you could work out courses fairly simply, because unlike the observers who was going to be their life, we were just had the need to know, really, more than anything else. What we were more concerned about was the sort of the flying side, both the theoretical side of flying, where we had lectures on how an aeroplane flies, why it flies, and so on, which was quite a news to some of us, actually, how it actually happened, the sort of the physics of it and that sort of thing. We did, first of all, had some familiarisation with the aircraft, where you went and sat in the aeroplane and looked at it. This was wonderful, this, because here you were getting an aeroplane, and there's something about the smell of an aircraft. Smell is a sense, scent as a sense, is very evocative. Like if I smell now, smell of acetone paint, it takes me straight back to flying, dope, aircraft, dope, that sort of thing. And petrol, aircraft engines, this sort of thing, oil smells, ship's deck. It's so the great thing, we got in this aeroplane, which smelt wonderfully, you know, there you were, this little cockpit. And we thought, what a great mass of instruments. We didn't realise it later. It was an extremely simple instrument panel with hardly anything on it at all, really. But to us it was something. We were given our parachutes in Mae West and told how to put them on and strap yourself in. This cumbersome thing hanging off you. You got in and you got into the aircraft and sat in this bucket seat in the Tiger Moth, and you looked around you, and it was only very small. It was a little tiny little aeroplane. You sort of put a little door down on the side, put a foot on the wing and stepped in and got in. You told very carefully where you had to step and where you hadn't, because you didn't want to go through the fabric. And then you were told about how the controls worked, in sort of a theory. Walk the stick, this is what's happened. Look at the wings, you can see the ailerons moving. Now, look in the mirror, you'll see your tail, see the rudder moving back to up and down, and the elevator up and down, the rudder side to side. And we're getting quite excited by now. And then we're going to have our first familiarisation flight. And that was something you really looked forward to.
Can you tell me about the cockpit? Because you mentioned the instruments that were on there. What type of instruments are there in a Tiger?
Well, it's a basic blind flying paddle, which would be the 6 instruments, a turbine bank indicator, airspeed indicator, altimeter, what else would it be? Pet fuel gauge, turn and bank indicator, what else? Something else on the right hand side, I can't remember offhand now. But six instruments, which with a paddle which we had in all through our flying, really. You just sort of, you looked at that, that was it. There were other little things, various odd instruments for little things like switches, so you could theoretically drop bombs, but we never did any of that in this case. You had a Gosport tube to speak to the instructor. You hadn't got radio connection there. The Gosport tube was just a tube you sort of shouted through this, and it plugged in into your ears, and you listened, hopefully heard what was being said. Very important you did, because so that you would the instructor tell you what to do. Then we had, as I say, our first familiarisation flight, and that was fantastic, that getting in this aeroplane. And starting up was interesting, because they had a series of young lads who were about 15 or 16 year olds, Welsh boys, who came from mainly from a place called Lower Mountain near Mold, and they worked as assistants. They weren't mechanics, they weren't doing the mechanical side, but their main job was sort of helping to push the aeroplanes around and start them. And when I think about it, it was rather a dangerous business, because first of all you had to switch on the engine, and then you did what was called suck in, where you pull the propeller around a couple of times, right, and then you switch the second switch on to check your no mag drop, and then you said contact, and this young lad got hold of the propeller, gave it a big swing, and it started it up. He started it by hand, and only now do I realise sort of how dangerous it was. These kids playing around starting up aeroplanes every day, but then this wonderful crackling sound of the engine starting up, and it trundled out he went in this thing, and the instructor was in front in the front cockpit, you were in the back cockpit, and he said, so to keep your hands on the stick and the rudder just lightly and feel what I'm doing all the time, you see. So these wonderful things were moving in your hands and your feet, were bounded along the grass, because you couldn't go on the runway, because Tiger Moth had a tail skid, and you couldn't work on a concrete runway without a tail wheel. So we kept up. There was one runway there, but we kept on the grass. And you bumped and bounded along, and suddenly you were in the air and you were flying. And then as I've always felt this in flying, even nowadays in an airliner, you don't rise above the ground. The ground drops away from you. It's a totally different thing. So you're in this world of your own with the aeroplane. Everything else is in a different world, to do with different things and different people. And we flew around over the aerodrome, over the top of Summers Iron Works, which gave you a bump. The plane went up and down a bit of the heat. And I can remember that coming round, and he did very simple flying things like turning and left, and just get the feel of it. Try this and try that, and then you were actually allowed to sort of fly it with him holding it. And he said, "Be very careful." I always say, when you take over, you say, "I've got her." And when you hand it back, you say, "You've got her," and I've got to say, "I've got her." So we know exactly who's flying the thing, you see. Because he said, we don't want to find nobody's flying like this. and then we started on our flying training. We did fairly simple takeoffs and landings, simple turning, and flying around in general. Worked up to this idea of your first solo, and this was the absolute crucial thing.
Can I take you through those little bits that you did first?
Yes, yes.
I mean, there's one thing that's interesting is, what's the technique basically for keeping a plane straight and level?
Straight and level, right. Well, the main thing is you look at the nose of the aircraft and compare it with the horizon. That's your sort of basic line of sight, if you like. And you know from that whether you're going up or down, or whether you're going left or right. But you've also got your instruments, the turn and bank indicator, which will tell you if you're banking or turning, and if you're skidding. If the turn and bank indicator, there's the one that moves with the rudder and the ailerons. Now, if the rudder and ailerons are moving against each other, you're skidding. So you learn to find that. You can tell in an open cockpit aircraft, it's quite handy because you can feel the wind on your face anyway. So it's rather good, I think, to start off in an open cockpit plane. It's very helpful because you feel what is happening more, if you know what I mean. And you the first sensations, I think, are that when you're first handling the thing, you know, here am I, I'm sitting here up in this aeroplane, and I'm actually flying it. Good heavens, isn't this amazing? And let's do things very gently at first, the first gentle moves to make sure you keep it, your nose on the horizon as you went round. That was important. Then when you did a steep turn, you had to stick well over and rudder and keep it going. Don't let it fall, don't let the nose rise, don't let it skid. And to start, it's like driving a car. To start with, you wonder how you're going to manage all these different hand and feet activities. And then the time comes when you get to the stage where you don't think you're doing it, as in driving a car. You don't think, I'm pressing on the clutch, or I'm using the brake, or I'm changing gear. Your hands and feet do it, and you get to that stage. So after a while, after a few hours, 2 or 3 hours probably, you're quite comfortable moving around in the aeroplane, in the air, in the three dimensions. And then you start things like really flying it, where you're doing things like, for instance,